Hello and welcome to this week's installment of Nucleus Investment Insights. My name is Mark and I'll be hosting today's webinar. Today we ask the question, does your portfolio need space? To answer this question, we're very fortunate to be joined by a special guest, Dr. Andrew Barton. Dr. Barton holds a PhD in aerospace engineering and has worked with a number of local international space ventures over the last 20 years. He's currently the research program manager at SmartSat, which is a consortium of universities and research institutes funded by the Australian government. Dr. Andrew Barton, welcome to Nucleus Investment Insights.
Hi, thanks. Great to be with you.
Thank you. And as usual, we're also joined by Damien Klassen, the head of investments here at Nucleus Wealth. Good afternoon, Damien.
Hi, Mark.
Before we start, a quick housekeeping message. As usual, a reminder that please do subscribe to our YouTube channel and click on the bell to be notified when we go live or when we have a new webinar that you can watch, or alternatively, follow on your preferred podcast platform. Apologies. For those listening in live, feel free to drop your questions in the YouTube live stream chat and have them answered along the way. Now, over to you, gentlemen.
Thanks, Mark. Yeah, so I guess what I wanted to try and do, so we're getting Andrew in to talk really about space technology. So this, we read a lot about some of the plutocrat sort of race for space race on at the moment between Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk. And we see sort of that, in recent years, there's been a number of sort of space companies or space mining companies sort of start up and then close back down again. And I guess what I really wanted to talk about was some of the recent breakthroughs, the changes in costs, and sort of having a look at sort of big picture about the whole space industry. And there's certainly companies we own or have owned, defense contractors and ones like that have exposure. And so I thought it was a great opportunity to speak to somebody who's got his boots on the ground or in the sky, so to speak. And so great to have Andrew aboard. So I might start, Andrew, with a question about, the recent breakthroughs and sort of cost changes, because I think that was one thing we've spoken about in the past is that there has been a bit of a step change in terms of the types of costs that we're looking at in this space.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of that change is due to the innovations by Elon Musk at SpaceX. He's really driving the market down in terms of cost per kilogram to orbit, which is the main metric that we measure with. And so the reusable rocket systems that he's developing, firstly, the Falcon 9 system that's actually been operational for quite a while now and serving a lot of customers. There's also a Falcon Heavy that works a little bit, but not so much. It's mainly used for some US government defense missions. And this new Starship rocket that he's developing now, even bigger, which will drop the costs even lower per kilogram to orbit.
And so what's the so part of it's the reusable nature that sort of dropped the cost. What's in terms of the next set of costs for dropping? What's sort of driving that in terms of this?
Yeah. So definitely there are some other trends aside from just the reusability. So even before SpaceX had really mastered reusability of the Falcon 9. They were already the cheapest launch provider by a significant margin. And so some of the things that they did is they cut through some of the bureaucracy that really was sort of festering, if you like, within the government-driven space sector. They built a vertically integrated company that had most of the manufacturing under one roof in one team. So they followed a much more modern tech company kind of approach in terms of the staffing and the management. He also invested heavily early on in some key propulsion technologies and designed a system from the ground up that's designed for cost effectiveness. So that investment began in the early 2000s, and they bore the fruit of that investment probably starting around 2010. They started to offer those commercial services, and of course the background to all of that is we're now in the information age, the technology age, where IT systems, microprocessors, massive internet connectivity mean that general technical work can get cheaper and you can develop more complex systems in a faster and more efficient way. So SpaceX has also been a pioneer at that. And Elon Musk's history before SpaceX was founding a couple of quite successful tech companies, including PayPal. So he really knows about those back office IT systems as well.
And is it sort of a, is it almost a bit of a step change as well? I think a lot of his stuff is unmanned. And I think they've even got as one of their part of their mantra is fail, like whatever it is, you know, build, develop, fail, you know, I can't remember these exact terms. Whereas I guess, you know, from 20 years ago, because everything was manned, a lot of it was manned, you're sort of like, well, fail isn't an opportunity. We need to go overboard to make sure we're not blowing up astronauts versus being able to say, well, you know, we'll accept the fact that we will fail, things won't work, but then we'll learn from it and go on. Is there an element of that? And then I guess the whole pride of the space race, we don't want our things to blow up.
Right. So actually, I don't think you've accurately captured the trends there that really influenced this. So it's true that SpaceX today is launching mostly unmanned things. However, they're also at the forefront of developing human space flight capability, and they are servicing NASA, delivering astronauts to the space station already, and they have much bolder plans with human spaceflight in the near future. So it's not really accurate to say that SpaceX's unique philosophy is just because they work with unmanned systems. There's a broader trend in the aerospace and defense sector, which is very government controlled. And when government bureaucrats are funding a project, be it a manned project that eventually plans to send humans or just an unmanned project delivering a satellite to orbit, The bureaucrats who control it are very, very risk averse. And they'll go to great lengths and they'll spend great amounts of money and time to check every detail of that prime contractor's work to minimize risk, to drive the risks down to zero. And particularly for unmanned systems, and this is where you're kind of right, particularly for unmanned systems, you can save a lot of money and time if you're willing to take a few risks early, especially early in the development, and suffer a few mishaps and explosions and have an attitude of learning from those mistakes. And you do hear that attitude also in the sort of software tech companies, by the way, as well.
Yeah.
And so when Elon's rockets explodes, he celebrates that explosion. So he hasn't killed any people yet, so that's an easy thing to celebrate. That celebration is also the sign that they're learning, and also it's a chance to gain media attention. So he almost turns it around to get more momentum for the company.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And because I guess at one extreme you could draw it as, look, he's cutting corners and therefore, you know, creating all these risks. And the other one is saying, well, if you're not actually endangering human lives and you're saying, well, rather than spending three times as much to have a perfect launch, you'll spend a third as much, but you'll be able to do it three times and learn a lot more from, you know, and maybe one of those will blow up or two might blow up, but you sort of, yeah, you get
yeah,
more
so those it. Failures are really important, actually. And, you know, the counter argument or the converse of what you're saying is the space shuttle experience. So this was supposed to be a highly reliable launch vehicle, carrying people, and in the end, what was its reliability? It suffered two mission failures out of something like 136 missions in total. So it had a higher than 1 in 50 chance of failing it catastrophically. And so it's just when you're dealing with complicated systems, you actually need to test them a lot, and then progressively test them and learn from those failures.
Yeah. Okay. So the current sort of investment avenues we've got is defense contractors. So there's a lot of them out there, but I guess Raytheon and mental blanks on names. Honeywell. Those types of Northrop Grumman, those types of bigger ones where it makes up quite a small part of it. You have Elon and Jeff Bezos. We haven't spoken about Jeff, what your thoughts are on him into the SpaceX and Blue Origin, and then a bunch of startups. So I guess, do you want to give us sort of a bit of color for the types of companies that are out there?
Yeah, sure. So until about 15 years ago, the really complex space system development was dominated by those big prime contractors, aerospace and defense prime contractors, and they play a game of consolidating, acquiring nearby businesses and growing bigger and going after government grants, not grants really, but government procurement contracts. and they become these big behemoths who can do quite impressive stuff, but they're not innovative. Around 15, 20 years ago, we started to have the emergence of startups, and some of them are really, really small startups, just a garage startup tinkering with small satellites, but some of them are bigger ones funded by those tech billionaire types, Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, and Richard Branson is not a tech billionaire, but he's a billionaire, and he also funds these things. So you're right to paint that picture of today of those three main categories of private efforts to develop space tech, and they've all got their own kind of strengths and weaknesses and their own philosophy.
And then I guess that where they're looking to make money, I suppose, is that there's government research. So they're basically saying, okay, there's government research. They're launching stuff at whatever cost of X, and we can do it half of X, and so we can try and bid and get those contracts. There's satellites. There's tourism. And then I guess there's sort of this whole idea about refueling and some manufacturing type stuff. Is that sort of, I guess, we'll go through each of them in detail.
Yeah, you've captured most of the major ones. So I think it's pretty useful to think a bit about the chronology here. So the first segment of the space industry that was profitable and attracted private investment was telecommunications. And so many of you would have used satellites to get TV. That was a very profitable business, still is today. Those satellites are up at geostationary orbit. It's relatively high, big expensive endeavors, hundreds of millions of dollars per satellite. And so there's a small number of companies, large companies around the world, who have been making money in that sector for decades. Then around the late 90s, I think it's probably a right time to describe it, a few business models emerged related to Earth observation, so taking images of the Earth from space. But most of those were heavily government subsidized. Government's a great customer for those images, of course. And we didn't really see a lot of profitability in the Earth observation market yet. I would argue there's a few profitable companies, but the telecommunications sector still dominates the profit potential in the space sector today. Another area that's important is navigation services. And so the governments are putting up their own navigation satellite constellations, like the GPS system that we use every day almost. There's a bunch of downstream companies who use that space infrastructure with ground-based products to provide new services like asset tracking and positioning. So that's actually a really dynamic sector of the space industry. It's a bit less fancy, but it's really growing pretty quickly. There's quite a few companies in that sector as well. So that's where we stand today. And then you sort of mentioned a few of the other segments which are on the horizon. I can certainly talk about them as well.
Yeah, sure. So, tourism, that's probably the still just for the we saw Jeff sort of just return from his visit into space. I think if it's the world's richest person, it's probably not quite ready for the mass market, but I don't know your thoughts on let's talk about those launch costs you're saying, because I think that's obviously come down a lot. So what are we talking dollars per kilo now, and what are the sort of goals for the industry?
Yeah, right. So if you're flying a payload on a Falcon 9 reusable rocket, your prices are something around $2,000 to $3,000 per kilogram.
And how far is that getting me? Sorry, in terms of, because it's vastly different, isn't it? How high I want to go?
Yeah, height is probably not the most important parameter. It's whether you're going into orbit or not. So if you do a suborbital flight, like Jeff Bezos's recent flight, you consume a lot less propellant. Your rocket is much smaller. So that to carry a payload to that on that kind of flight is much cheaper than to put a payload into Earth orbit. But SpaceX is routinely putting payloads into Earth orbit at that price point I mentioned, $2,000 to $3,000 per kilogram, which is an order of magnitude or so cheaper than what it was 20 years ago, and maybe even 10 years ago for most of the other providers. So
of magnitude, are we talking like we're just knocking a zero off? Is that our?
Yes, 10 times cheaper. It used to be $20,000 per kilogram. that was kind of the going rate for decades, I believe. And so that's kind of what the efficiencies of the SpaceX business model and the Falcon 9 rocket can achieve. The Starship and Super Heavy booster combination, which is currently developing in Texas, that could go, I don't know, maybe even 10 times or more cheaper once you're reusing that huge vehicle. You've got all these economies of scale.
Right. Okay, so you're talking, so $200. So if you're talking, I don't know, somebody plus their luggage, I don't know how much luggage you need, but sort of 100 kilos, say, you want you're talking...
That's the distant future. That's the long-term future, is that people can afford to go to space on a reusable system. But there's so much testing to prove it's reliable and safe. So the figures I was mentioning there really relate to cargo, where you can afford to lose one in 100 of your missions.
Right. Okay.
I think when you say traveling into space with your luggage, or you forget you got to take your own air as well.
Also,
that's another thing.
So don't just weigh yourself. Yeah, there's a lot of other weight you've got to carry with you per person.
Exactly. So, I mean, we have a question on our channel saying, are these companies that we've been discussing, are they cheaper than the Russians? I mean, is there any Russian companies coming out? Because we always thought the great space race was the US and Russia, you know?
Or China as well.
Or China, absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
So the Russians were the cheapest for a long, long time. And SpaceX started beating them on price and reliability around 12 years ago, I think. And so actually the Russian space industry is suffering because of that. They're getting less contracts to launch stuff. They're finding it harder to make a profit, and they're losing good engineers, and their reliability is going down as a result of that, I personally believe. So Russia is quite frankly a declining space power, whereas China is an emerging space power, absolutely. China hasn't really made it big time on the international market for space services, but they've got a lot of activity there now, and it's almost certain that soon we will see SpaceX-like companies emerging in China.
And the other one then, and Europe, what's Europe up to?
So Europe, it's a richer, you know, region, and they've got some great technology. They have got their own kind of desire to have sovereign capability, indigenous capabilities in Europe. So they maintain a launch vehicle program, the Ariane program. It's known to be very expensive. The taxpayers probably aren't completely happy with all the money they're spending to subsidize that service, but at least it gives European governments an option to launch, from European rockets from European territory. And even if they're doing that at a higher price, that gives them some strategic capabilities that they want to keep. But they're also going to have to look seriously at reusability. They're not investing heavily in reusability yet, but that's also massive disruption that they're going to have to adjust to.
Mm. And Australia, where's Australia sits in the pecking order. That's obviously, you know, something you're near and dear to your heart.
Yeah. So I worked overseas for most of my career. I came back to Australia 3 years ago to try and join this space industry that's growing here. And I'm having enormous fun doing that and working with some great people and companies here. We are a great country to do certain things in the space industry, and probably a country that's not suited for doing other things. We haven't done it yet, but pretty soon we might. Australia looks like a good location to launch rockets from into space. We have relatively low sea and air traffic around our country. We have a lot of ocean around us as well, where when those rockets take off, they drop the first stage or the second stage of the rocket. You want to drop it into the ocean. If there's an accident, that explosion happens over the ocean, so it's safer. So we've got that geographic advantage. We've also got the sort of governance of Australia. So we've got a modern free market economy with good international relations. So it's a good place to do business in general. And so what we're seeing now in the Australian space sector is a lot of people trying to build new companies and new capabilities in the country that kind of replicate what's overseas, but trying to look for those niches that might be a bit more competitive, where we can compete a bit more.
Mm. And in terms of government support in Australia, what's the sort of attitude towards it at the moment?
So historically, Australia invested very, very little in space activities. There was a period of the 60s and 70s where we were part of American and European space exploration efforts out at Woomera with a lot of launch activities. But then for decades, the government kind of turned its back on in-space technologies and launch technologies and focused only on using the space systems that other nations built. And we're quite good at using that stuff. But when it comes to building it, we've only just come back to that now in the last few years. So the Australian Space Agency is only a couple of years old. It's got a pretty modest budget so far, and it's not funding a lot of that really complex upstream technologies. But I sense that it's going in that direction. I think there will be some opportunities, particularly in the smaller launch vehicles and the smaller satellite sectors.
Okay, sorry, and we got sidetracked from the tourism. Okay, so it was we spoke about $2,000 a kilo to get something into orbit. In terms of the types of costs, though, just to get into the Jeff Bezos, it's at the much lower level. How much cheaper is it to get to that level?
So there's not a lot of demand to send cargo on a suborbital flight. There are a few kinds of experiments. It's a research activity. Sending people on a suborbital flight is quite interesting because you get these amazing views and experience. And that's what Jeff Bezos is doing with Blue Origin. He was kind of proving out that system recently, commercially proving it out in a sense, and as was Richard Branson with his suborbital flight recently. So both of those companies are selling tickets in the hundreds of thousands of dollars per flight. I think it's $250,000 for the Virgin Galactic one, and it's a bit cheaper for the Blue Origin one, which is slightly. I won't give you figures. I can't remember the details.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of price that you're charged right now if you want to take a flight in a suborbital rocket.
Yeah, but I guess what you're saying is, given the way things are developing, you could see sort of say within 10 years, maybe it's 20 grand instead of 200 grand.
Right. So price drops for the suborbital flights. I think that's inevitable as more players come online and as they mature their system technologies. I wouldn't really be able to guess how low it would go, but maybe in 10 years, it could be below $100,000 per flight.
Right. Okay. And then, okay, so that was the tourism side. So there's the, I guess there's this idea about refueling and the idea that if you can get the fuel from in space, then it's way cheaper than trying to take it up. So there's a whole sort of industry around, there's a whole, I guess, potential future industry around that. And so I guess your thoughts, you're working on personally?
Sorry, what was the last part of the question?
Was that something you were working on personally?
I'm not directly working on that, although I have touched on certain issues related to that. In general, what you're talking about there is a new set of markets where space products are being kind of delivered in space to users who are in space. And so today we have very, very few people in space. We have a bunch of satellites and machines in space, but they're kind of supported from the Earth at launch, and they're not really supported during their mission. So to make these new in-space markets work, we need to have some new approaches where people and or systems in space are getting replenished or supported from other space assets. And so we're on the cusp now of an era where satellites can be refueled by other satellites in space. The basic technology has been there for quite a while, but the business models haven't quite closed yet. So one company, Orbit Fab, they just announced an investment yesterday of another $15 million, I think it was, from a major US aerospace prime contractor. So they're trying to demonstrate, basically a satellite that maneuvers to where another satellite is in orbit, tops up its fuel tanks, and then moves on to service other satellites.
And where's it getting the fuel from? Is that still launching from Earth, though, or is it trying to generate fuel?
So the near-term opportunity there is that you'd launch that propellant from Earth. But in the longer term, you would actually have some advantages to source that propellant from space, so from the surface of the moon in certain locations or from asteroids.
Wow. I was generally under the impression that most of the satellites that are in orbit, for instance, are using solar power, solar panels. Is that not the case anymore?
They use solar panels for electricity, but that electricity is normally consumed just to carry out the functions of the, of that satellite system, be it communications or sensing. Mm-hmm. There are electric propulsion technologies, so some mm-hmm. satellites are equipped with very, very efficient thrusters that they have a propellant on board, but it's not like a combustion of that propellant. It's just shooting that propellant out very fast in a jet that mm-hmm. gives you a thrust. So that's electric propulsion, and that's an active area of both research and commercial activity. But the more common method for satellites to maneuver is chemical rocket propulsion, which is similar to what is actually used in the launch vehicles.
Oh, okay. Mm.
Right. And but I'm assuming most satellites only need that irregularly. Is that right? They're sort of sitting in roughly in orbit, and then they just need to, it's not like a constant, it's just sort of repositioning every now and again. Is that right?
Yeah, most of the commercial satellites in Earth orbit make very relatively infrequent modifications to their orbit just to maintain it. So they spend most of their propellant at the beginning of life when they enter into that orbit, and at the end of their life where they have to get out of the orbit. As we move towards an era of that in-space transport, in-space services I mentioned before, we're going to need to have more of these satellites that can maneuver while in Earth orbit to deliver those services. And there's a few businesses chasing after that market as well now.
Mm. Now, one of the other ones, so manufacturing, which initially when you hear that, people want to make stuff in space, sounds like, why would you bother? But apparently there's a few... I think there's some organ, is it human organs that are efficient if you do them in space? And there's some fiber, there's some fiber that's quite efficient if it's done in space rather than on Earth. You got your thoughts around sort of manufacturing in space and what that means?
So the in space manufacturing conversations today tend to revolve around taking up some sort of raw product from Earth, taking advantage of the microgravity environment up there in space to make something, and then bringing it back to Earth to customers. So I haven't seen a really compelling high profit opportunity business model in that sector, although there are some interesting research projects like the ones you just mentioned. I think the more interesting commercial market for in-space manufacturing is where you keep those systems, that equipment that you produce in space. And so there's a lot more kind of mechanical manufacturing than really high-tech products, if you like. So think of big trusses or solar panels or habitats for people to go for a space holiday. That stuff is much better made in space than on ground. And there's a company called Made in Space, actually, from the US, which is pioneering that area.
Right. And so I'm interested in that as a thought, because it seems like if you've got to lift all the materials up there anyway, that's the cost. And so it feels like it would be easier to just make it down here and then lift it up. But I guess that's where's the real advantage?
It depends what you're lifting up. If you're carrying up sort of bulk material like water or steel, then you can put it on a bumpy launch vehicle that's sort of high chance of failure, because if it crashes, you only lose some bulk material.
Right.
But if you're sending up an exquisite satellite system with deployable systems, because the fairing of the rocket is too small, and you've got this really complex system, it takes ages and ages and lots of money to test it on the ground, and it's still got a high risk of failure. And if it fails on orbit, you can't even go up there and fix it, so you may have to even just discard it. So if we can start to shift towards doing some of that complex assembly in orbit, we change the economics and the risk profile of that thing, and the cost of getting stuff up there now becomes, as that cost is getting lower and lower, you can actually start to think about bulk material being sent up more easily. And then what do you do with that bulk material? Let's add value to it.
Right. Yeah. Excellent. And so, I mean, I guess so for the large part, most of the stuff we're talking about is all, we're still trying to find government research. Sorry, it's either the satellite sort of communication side or government research, really. I guess these other ones are sort of still just trialing sort of methods for is there a market first, whereas we know there's a that satellite market and the government research. Is that fair to say?
No, I think we've passed through that era. What you've described there was 10 or so years ago. So what we're seeing now is there are legitimate private companies who are selling to commercial markets with consumers here on Earth, and they're selling space services. And so Earth observation is actually a market now.
Right. Okay.
Now, there's different types of Earth observation. There's taking images, which kind of, there's a lot of free stuff out there from governments already. So that one's not really pioneering, but there's a company called Spire Global, which is using advanced sensors to help measure the atmosphere and also detect things like illegal fishing. So you're starting to see these new applications that, you know, people on Earth will buy. Those people may be governments, but they buy it in a commercial way because they're buying it typically from an overseas supplier at a market rate, and they're not funding the development or the research associated with that satellite system. They're just saying, oh, I need that service from space, I want to buy it. And so that's actually a great opportunity for Australia. We have a few companies around here who are also trying to do things like that.
And so we just got a question in about the space junk. Is there a service for cleaning up space junk?
In fact, this is a really hot topic, and I just got asked yesterday who in Australia is doing a business model around space junk removal, and the answer is nobody in Australia, but there are some people overseas. There's a Japanese company called Astroscale, which just did its first demo in the last month or so, where they grappled a piece of space junk. That's one step of the process. Eventually, you'd sort of grapple them and take them back to Earth orbit or just destroy them or reuse them even. So hot topic. Going out there and physically getting the debris is becoming a thing now. But also there's business associated with where is the debris? So tracking of space debris, that's a commercial service that other companies are also trying to develop.
Right. But that still sounds like a government type. Yeah, it's not like
a government thing, but in fact, who are the consumers of that service? So yes, governments, but now that we've got companies with thousands of their own satellites in orbit providing commercial services now, so now I'm referring to, for example, SpaceX's Starlink program, completely separate thing to their launch program.
Yeah.
They need to know where that debris is that can take out their satellites, and there's more and more debris coming, being created now with so much activity. So they're actually paying, companies like SpaceX are paying good money for intelligence essentially on where that debris is.
Right. Okay. So let's talk about, that's a good intro into that. Do you want to talk about their Starlink system?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So the commercial satellite telecommunications market, as I described earlier, was dominated by geostationary satellites, which are, there's a relatively small in number and they're large and expensive. And they're far away from Earth, which means that they're good if you've got a dish that can just point up to space. But if you want to be able to move around, you're in a camper van or you're in a remote area and want to set up something temporarily, you don't get good service from those geostationary satellites. There's another system called Iridium, and which has been in place for a few decades now, which was heavily funded by governments. It went bankrupt once and got funded again. Iridium talks to a phone. You've probably seen them. These Iridium handsets. They're like a 19
satellite phones.
Satellite phones. They're like a
I have 1980s
mobile phone.
Yeah. I have one that all it does is messages back to tell you where you are and shows you a GPS for when you're out on whitewater rafting or hiking or stuff like that. Yeah.
So that does have a commercial market, but you couldn't really justify the business model, that very expensive constellation of satellites to provide that service. It was justified by government need, and the governments use it a lot. So Starlink is the first mega constellation that actually is trying to close a commercial business model. And what they want to do is provide broadband internet anywhere on Earth from a constellation of over 1,000 satellites. In fact, they've already got over 1,000 up there. They're planning to launch even over 40,000 they've applied for licensing to launch, and they're well on their way to doing that with their rocket systems. And what the user would experience then is something about the size of a large pizza, which is it's the Starlink dish, and it's a much more sophisticated dish than those reflectors that they use for that geostationary TV kind of transmissions. But with modern electronics technology, those kinds of complex systems are becoming cheaper and cheaper to produce at scale. And so they're currently selling it for a couple of hundred bucks, and they're making a loss per unit. But as their technology improves and as volumes increase, eventually they should reach a break-even point on that user terminal. Starlink just this year started selling services in Australia. So I think even right now you can go out and buy one of these user terminals, and you pay about $100 a month for a subscription, which is pretty expensive for internet. But if you're in a remote area and there's no cellular connections, then that could be a really good deal.
And that's pretty similar to what people pay, you know, the top plans on NBN are sort of that type of price. So yeah. And I guess that sort of leads to that whole thought, isn't it, that if you've got that stage, then it might make sense for governments then to start including that as part of their, you know, okay, let's not send fiber everywhere. It's far cheaper just to subsidize some of these other services for people in remote areas for those.
Yeah, I think so. I think that could happen.
Mm. And then the other thing we spoke about, and I know we've got a few gaming on our own staff, is that so the latency is very low though, isn't it, on these ones?
So SpaceX advertises lower latency than any other communications option, including ground-based fiber optics. Mm. And the physics behind that is quite straightforward. The light travels faster through a vacuum. So if you've got a series of satellites that are shooting a laser or a combination of radio links and laser links directly over the Earth to your destination, it will actually be significantly faster than traditional networks.
Yeah. And so, you know, I guess that's where I've got a son who's very much into the latency and all that type of stuff of these, and so so I can see where you can get some hardcore gamers onto the if it's only a couple hundred bucks, I mean they're shelling out thousands of dollars for their rigs to be able to game better, so yeah, knock a few bit off. And I guess and you're talking about what was the other application then, was video calls, that was the other one, was it?
I think video calls and high-speed trading would be another one. So all of them, it's just users who have a high demand for low latency and who are willing to spend for it.
Yeah. And well, so you can – oh, sorry.
I could see that being used for, like, telemedicine, for instance. They are experimenting with doctors and surgeons in one country and the patient being in another country. And it could work here in Australia as well, where you've got the best cardiologist in Sydney – doing a surgery on somebody in, well, Alice Springs, for want of a better explanation. Yeah.
But it's probably more, it's just much if you're saying, well, if you're dealing with your London office or your New York office and there's whatever it is, if you can, everyone's got to wait a little bit after everyone talks, it's not much, and you know, it's not enough to worry everyone. But if you could cut that in a half or a third, and you're a big company and it's only going to cost you a couple of grand a year on either end, it's like, well, yeah, you can see the benefits to that. Right. Yeah. So that's the ones. So then we were just talking sort of some of the pie in the sky stuff. So we've seen a number of asteroid miners go broke in recent years. There was a few years ago, a couple of reports of these asteroids worth, you know, quadrillions of dollars and things like that. So the whole mining part, I'm just interested in the whole, the back of the envelope sort of ideas around when does that actually become reasonable to do? And so maybe I could paint the picture to people of saying, well, there are some asteroids out there that are sort of made almost completely of iron ore, gold, platinum, nickel, and the idea is you land something on it. The mining, I think, is a bit easier in that often the material isn't as, you know, it's not as stuck to the earth as I suppose, because it's got less gravity. And then you pull it back to Earth. So I don't know if you've got any sort of big picture thoughts on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And some asteroid mining startups did go broke, but there'll be more in the future. And I think someday somebody will crack this. So those ones in particular were focused on bringing stuff back to Earth. At least that's what their public relations was about. So like you mentioned, those high value ores, which are, you know, rare earth metals, or at least hard to find here on Earth or hard to mine. And there's pretty good scientific evidence of what you were saying, that some of these asteroids out there within reach contain enormous quantities of certain materials that are valuable. I don't think gold is top of the list, although it would be present in asteroids, but it's probably not the one you'd want to go after. It's platinum group metals were the ones that were most often touted by, what was the name of that company? Deep Space Industries.
Yep.
Yes, I think and mining it is not particularly complex, although we don't have the systems today that could go out there and grab it and bring it back. We need to develop those systems. There's a few companies out there under the radar trying to do that, but it's still a few more years until we're doing that. At the moment, there's a bit more emphasis on moon mining, and moon resource utilization is probably a more politically acceptable way of describing it. And on the moon, you'd be looking at things like water. Water is relatively heavy, but it's also really important for life support, and it can also be used to make rocket fuel. So that's probably one of the earlier ores that will be mined on the moon. And asteroids.
And so dollars per kilo of water.
So yes, there's a really interesting figure, and I don't have it to mind, but NASA has actually signed a kind of example contract with a couple of lunar companies to buy water from them on the moon. It's like we'll buy 1 kilogram of water for this extraordinarily high price, right?
Yeah.
Tens of thousands of dollars. So what they're basically saying with that is, one day in the future, we'd actually like to buy water from commercial suppliers who operate a mine for water on the moon. Water is believed to exist in reasonable quantities in the permanently shadowed regions near the moon's north and south pole. These are craters that never see sunlight, and so the ice kind of just collects in there.
Right, and other, so in terms of the other mining that they're looking for the moon, so what are the main metals that they're looking for, and you're saying that's for sort of restocking mainly?
Yeah, so water would be the kind of thing that would be that replenishment business model.
Right. Okay. Yep.
But if you were building infrastructure on the moon of any kind, or human bases or whatever, big antennas for science projects or tourism facilities, you'd want to have you want to have building materials. It wouldn't make sense to bring them from Earth. You'd want to mine them there. And the moon's surface has got all sorts of things like titanium and aluminium and iron, all sorts of things which are useful building materials. So certainly people will be doing that in the future. Or if you wanted to build large structures in Earth orbit, then either the moon or asteroids could be a plausible source of those bulk materials.
Right. Okay. Because I mean, I guess just for listeners, you know, in broad sense, if we're going to talk sort of per ton prices, you know, iron ores, well, $150 a ton, and its longer term price is sort of $50 a ton. So it's like it's a pretty cheap metal. It's pretty hard to justify. And then you go to sort of going flying out somewhere and having to bring back iron ore. And then you go all your nickels and coppers and everything is sort of $10,000, $5,000 to $10,000 a ton. And then your platinums are sort of $30 million a ton or $40 million a ton.
Yeah.
But so I guess what I'm thinking, though, Andrew, in terms of the big picture, a ton still seems like, okay, that'll fit in the sort of, that's sort of the roughly a back of a truck, you know? if you pick that up and mined it on a planet, well, I guess what I'm wondering is that cost to get it back and forth, you know, if you've mined it on an asteroid somewhere, you know, past Mars, do you just sort of push it in the general direction of Earth and eventually it'll end up there? You sort of stick a net around it and push it and then you pick it up the other end? Or do you need to, like, what are the rough costs, I guess, if you, because I think I saw something that some Japanese satellite went and got something from an asteroid and then brought back like 1 gram and it costs them, whatever, hundreds of millions of dollars. So I don't know. I guess that your thoughts around the actual mechanics of how that would work.
Yeah. So we're still in the era of scientific exploration of the asteroids. And so that's why those ridiculous cost ratios exist now.
Yeah.
But if you took a practical engineering approach, commercially oriented approach to it, and you designed a mission, you could go and scoop up off one of these asteroids, you know, a ton or a fraction of a ton of regolith is what you call it, the material that's there, which contains these high value ores. You could shoot it back to Earth with a rocket system. The total mission cost is probably in the hundreds of millions of dollars to do that once you've got all the basic technology elements in place. So it's not dissimilar to the cost. It wouldn't be, once the technologies are in place, too dissimilar to the cost profile of a mining operation on Earth. But where you get the differences is in the time it takes to deploy that system and then bring it back, time to develop the technologies, and also, you know, what you're bringing back would sort of distort the prices for that commodity here on Earth as well if you bring back too much.
Absolutely.
So how much do you bring back?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think that's obviously the thing with all these guys is it's a prisoner's dilemma type thing or whatever. That's the same with some mines on Earth. Like, I mean, that's BHP's been sitting on this Jansen potash mine in Canada for years, and it's so big that if they keep looking at it going, and it'll be so low cost, but they keep looking and going, okay, well, potash is whatever this price, the price of X, but if we build our mine, then we're going to flood the market, and then yes, we'll be the cheapest, but price is going to fall to half of that. So, you know, so they haven't built it for 20, 30 years. They've been sitting on it. Now they're just starting. So I can see exactly the same thing with those ones where, but it's a thought for me is that if it happens, we're still sort of 10 to 15 years away, I guess. If you're talking hundreds of millions now and that came down in a factor of 10 over 10 years, and you're saying, well, it's still only probably marginal. You know, if it's going to cost you 20 million and your ore's worth 30 million, then you're like, okay, it's only ballpark, you know, I don't need prices to fall very far before I'm losing money.
I think you're right with those sorts of numbers. So I don't know when it's going to become viable. It might be that it's not viable to bring it back to Earth anytime soon, but it is viable to use it in space near the resource location. Yeah. There's lots of opportunities for disruption. Think about, you know, artificial intelligence doing the mining. You don't have to have people controlling it on Earth. You could drop the costs like that. It's very hard to say, but it's really interesting to think about those kind of combined technical and sort of commercial business models.
Possibilities. And so actually the other thing, Costas, I'm interested then. So let's say we're saying we've brought it down by a factor of 10. It's $20 million to get it back. But in terms of getting it from in space back down to Earth, are there any major costs to that? Or is that just pretty cheap? You just drop it and you got to catch it at the
point. You drop it, but you have to drop it in a way that it survives the passage through the atmosphere, so the re-entry.
Yep.
And it just so turns out that Australia is also a great place to re-enter stuff. I think in the future, Australia will be a site for bringing stuff back. So we've got this massive desert area that we can kind of control and can get around. The Japanese science missions you mentioned, they re-entered, and NASA has also done stuff bringing back science samples to the Australian outback. So to design a system to re-enter the atmosphere, you need to use special materials. But the science is well known, and we've been doing it for decades for things that are closer to Earth. So that's not such a big leap for us.
But cost-wise, so I guess we spoke about $2,000 a kilo to get things into space. Mm. Is there sort of is it $2 a kilo to get it back down, or is it?
Maybe something like that. But it's not as significant a cost, I would suggest.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, well, the one part of this whole mining asteroids is the availability of an asteroid to mine. I mean, some of these asteroids come around one every 10,000 years, but are there that many asteroids going past that are accessible? I mean, it's no point having it beyond Saturn, for instance. I mean, given where we are.
That's right. So there's, you know, the ones that really come around infrequently are probably more like comets. And they're quite big and they contain a lot of water, but they're going to be hard to get and they're moving too fast. So the velocity difference is important because you need more propulsion to get there. So the most interesting ones would be no further away than Mars. There's the asteroid belt, as it's called. There's this big region.
I was thinking about that, yeah.
Lots of asteroids there of all different types.
Mm-hmm.
And scientists have spent decades trying to characterize them from a distance. We've approached a few of them up close with science missions, so we're learning more about them. There's a very small number of asteroids that are super close to Earth. Some of them pass through in near-Earth space. They pass through between the distance of the Earth and the Moon, for example. So you could theoretically grab one or impact one of them. There's also some asteroids which are kind of co-orbiting around the Sun with the Earth. And those are the ones which are the easiest to get to in terms of the propellant that you need. And so we could foreseeably, in a sort of typical space mission scenario of 5 years, we could imagine going up and grabbing a few kilograms from one of those ones. They're very small and they're very few of them, but it would be a good case point.
And in terms of, I guess one of the other things from government spend, I guess, is Earth protection systems. And so there's been flouted a few times as to whether that's this, but I guess is there any actual money being spent from governments on that at the moment, or any push for that?
Not in terms of hardware, but there are researchers who get a bit of funding. I think NASA's got an ongoing small program to look at the problem. But the evidence seems to suggest that the chances of Earth having a massive catastrophic comet or asteroid impact are very, very low in our generation sort of time frame.
Yeah. Yeah. But
can only find it in Hollywood.
Yeah.
But coming back to the space junk aspect, I mean, if you've got a company from Australia, hypothetically, that's going up there and can retrieve hammers and whatever else is up there, but say there's a satellite, for instance, that they can pick up. I mean, would say it's a Japanese satellite, say it's an American satellite, say it's a South African satellite, then don't you run into an issue about, you know, do I trust you to touch my stuff, you know? It's propriety, it's national security, you know, all this kind of stuff. And how would it work commercially, you know? I can only pick up the hammer, I can't pick up the satellite. Even though the satellite's taking up space, I can't put another satellite there.
Yeah, no, good questions. And in fact, all of the space industry is heavily, heavily infused with constraints and issues around international law. So space law is a thing which is a part of international law. And as you may know, international law isn't particularly rigorous or well-defined, and space law is the same. So as the space technology and capabilities emerge and business models emerge, the space law is following behind. Things like mining are also very contentious around space law. But the example you gave there, at the moment there's nobody who's really saying that there's a profitable business model of recycling debris into useful stuff in space. That may well emerge in the future. And yes, if it does emerge, they're going to have some pretty complex legal issues.
And that might actually be the stumbling block as to why they're not doing it.
Could be.
And I guess your best hope is that we get a space race between US and China or something like that. Or is that your, I don't know whether you follow any of the politics. I haven't seen too much in terms of, but you know, there's a lot of tension out there between the two countries.
I think we're already in a space race between the US and China. It's been going for a couple of decades, really. China put their first astronaut in space in the early 2000s, I believe. And now they're advancing quite quickly. And so they're showing an ability to replicate what the US did. And they're doing that replication faster and faster in the space sector, like in other sectors. So, no, we're in a space race, and China is well funded, big population, and they're getting smarter and smarter as well. And so they're going to start to dominate the commercial markets, and they're already probably number two space power in terms of military tech.
Because is there anything? I guess it was it was Sputnik, wasn't it, that was sort of sparked the whole space race, whereas like the Americans thought they were in front, and then all of a sudden they were like, just a minute, we're behind the Russians, and then we need to spend bucket loads of money. Mm-hmm. Not that, I guess what I'm wondering is there a Sputnik moment that you can see that China is working on that would actually spark the US to go, just a minute, we may not be as far in front as we thought, we need to get out in there and throw bucket loads of money at the sector again?
Yes, I think that would be when China establishes a permanent human base on the moon, because the US has been to the moon, but they went there on these short sorties and they came back. So if a permanent base was established there, that would be a major challenge to American hegemony.
Okay. So thing to watch. Excellent. I don't know if there's anyone else with any questions online, or Mark, have you got any? Anything major we've missed?
Yeah, well, good question.
Actually, it was a great conversation. I think we covered all of the really exciting parts of the industry.
Hey. Great. Well, do you want to give up?
Before, Damien, maybe you can comment on what is the investment window look like for people who are perhaps interested in investing?
Yeah,
because this happens to be on Nucleus Wealth, then maybe we should drag that in.
Absolutely. Look, from the investment side, I guess what I'm looking at is, look, we don't invest in startups. That's sort of our bread and butter is really the large cap stocks that are the lower risk ones, and with the idea that that's your core portfolio, and then you buy stocks around that, your satellites, so to speak, around your core portfolio are your higher risk investments where people might be interested in these ones, I guess. I'd look upon this as it's going to be easy to lose money in this space. There's plenty of places that are more than willing to, but you know, there's going to be some very interesting ones that end up making lots of money. We've got a lot of, a big part of our universe is the defense contractors. And so there's some stocks within that that we're following quite closely. The space stuff tends to be, not a huge part of their business, but it is there. So, and that's, that's one area we're looking. And I guess the thoughts we sort of keeping an eye on is although it's only a small part, you know, it's obviously nicely profitable. And if SpaceX and Blue Origin and there's other these startups starting to take away contracts that these guys would have otherwise won, then that's an issue for them. So, you know, we're not sort of that active in that space at the moment.
What about the picks and shovels? Companies, yeah, that
selling stuff to them. See, well, the SpaceX is not. Yeah, they're not part of the universe we're investing in. but look, Andrew's. You're maybe we'll give you this is a good intro to give you a chance to sort of to pitch your wares because you're doing some work with startups in this area.
Yeah, that's right. I've been involved in a mentoring or advising capacity to a number of startups, space startups. Over the last 5 to 8 years. And I also do consulting into space businesses who are looking to understand their market opportunity better. So that's a lot of that's about helping them to understand what government grants they could go for or how they should approach the market strategically. So I'm certainly available to help in a consulting capacity if someone in the investment community wants to understand the space tech industry and the business models of all these players.
Excellent, thanks. So we'll put some contact details in the show notes to where you can get in contact with Andrew if anyone's interested in more details.
That's right. Well, can we get on to, well, at that point we'll just get into the question of the week. And the question we've come up with is which avenue of space investment, as we've discussed, has the most promise? Is it the renewable energies? Is it the space junk? Is it the space tourism? Well, that's something for you to think about. And shall we wind up, I guess?
Yep.
Well, thank you, Dr. Barton, for your time today. I'm sure the viewers have found this probably a very fascinating and unique discussion. I've never had experienced something like this before myself. And before we let you go, we are going to be sharing some of your details in our notes so people can reach out to you. And thanks again to all of you who have watched this live, and for all the dudes who asked questions, we do welcome your feedback on this episode and any suggestions for future topics. Don't forget to click like on this video right now. And finally, if you know someone who would get something out of today's episode, and you know, who doesn't like space travel? Who has never thought about being an astronaut, you know? I mean, everybody's going to love this one. And to stay up to date with on news from us, you can follow us on social media. Thanks again for tuning in for myself, Mark, and the rest of the team here at Nucleus Wealth. We look forward to seeing you at the next one.